Welcome. I'm Andra, and this is the How Do You Know podcast. In this show, we'll learn how to make better decisions and open up our view to everything that's possible. I interview great decision makers to discover how they built and improved their process along the years. I really hope you'll find it useful. Let's dig in. Dr. Ana Yorga is the CEO and Chief Neuroscientist at BioBrain, a consumer neuroscience company that focuses on delivering non-conscious insights, which drive deeper customer engagement. She's also a medical doctor with a PhD in consumer neuroscience and a double MBA degree in marketing and finance. At the same time, she serves as a board member in the Neuromarketing Science and Business Association, and she is the co-editor of Ethics in Neuromarketing, a path-breaking book that explored the ethical challenges in the field. Her extensive expertise of consumer neuroscience, combined with her deep passion for bringing science to marketing, makes her a fascinating professional to talk to. As someone who spent over a decade working with business as well as academia, she is a unique source of field-tested information around how we behave and why we behave certain ways. Throughout our conversation, I discovered amazing facts about how our brain reacts to highly unpredictable environments and how we make decisions when we're in survival mode. We explored how our brain perceives cognitive effort and talked about how emotions influence our choices. I admit that I was fascinated with Anna's way of seeing the world and her decision-making process, and I quote-unquote stole a couple of revealing questions to help keep me grounded and, you know, as rational as possible through these deep, fast, and complex changes that we're living. I promise her insights can help you expand your know-how and help you pinpoint key elements that can improve your decisions, behavior, and results, no matter which area of your life you want to improve. So, enjoy! I'd love to start by kind of unpacking the core elements from this paragraph. In the Ethics in Neuromarketing research paper you co-authored in 2017, which I'll link to in the show notes, the paragraph reads, "The rationale behind neuromarketing is that human decision-making is not primarily a conscious process. Instead, there's increasing evidence that the willingness to buy products and services is an emotional process where the brain uses shortcuts to accelerate the decision-making process. At the intersection of economics, neuroscience, consumer behavior, and cognitive psychology, neuromarketing focuses on which emotions are relevant in human decision-making and uses this knowledge to make marketing more effective." So if you look at the bigger picture and go beyond marketing, what would be those emotions that dominate human decision making?
Okay, so I'll answer your questions about emotions, but first of all, I want to introduce another concept that is going to help us through our discussion today, and that is related to Kahneman's framework of conscious and subconscious processing. So he divided the functional brain, let's say, into systems, system one and system two. And he calls system one the subconscious processing that is very fast and relies on heuristics and biases, does not use too much energy. And it is the primary state that our brains want us to be in throughout the day. And I'll come back to that later. And system two is the brain processing when we are paying attention to what is going on around us. We are focused. We use a lot of energy to process the information around us. It's mainly when we are when we are learning something new. So, for example, when you learn to ride a bike, you are in system two because you have to pay attention to how to coordinate your body. And when you already learned how to ride a bike, it goes to the lower, let's say, subconscious processing, where you don't have to think about it. You just keep doing it and you are riding the bike. So this this framework is very important for us to understand how decision making happens. And as I said, there is a lot happening at the subconscious level. So there are Saltman, a professor from Harvard. His theory is that around 95% of the processing happens at the subconscious level. So that doesn't mean that our decisions are non-conscious or subconscious, that we're not aware of our decisions. That means that we are not consciously processing what we do throughout the day. And this is a very good thing, because if we were to do that, we would get tired so early in the morning, we'd not be able to do anything. And so I can give you an example for that. So it's like when you wake up in the morning, you know, you rely on past experiences, and you know that it is safe for you to get off the bed, to, you know, go in the kitchen to make a coffee. There's no monster jumping to eat you. Whereas if you don't know that and you have to consciously process every step you take, you might not get off the bed until midday. So the way the brain processes information is also related to the emotions that drive our behavior. And we are wired since kids to go after, to pursue the activities that bring us pleasure, that bring us a reward, and to just stay away from those activities that would get us hurt or punished. So this is how my kids learned the concept of hot. It was enough for them to touch a hot pot once, and they knew exactly what hot meant. They didn't touch it the second time. And throughout our lives and our behavior as consumers, employees, spouses, parents, we try to enhance those experiences that bring us pleasure and to stay away from those experiences that make us feel bad. So this also translates in our experience with a brand. So whenever a brand creates an unpleasant experience, why would we choose that brand? Why would we choose to continue our relationship with a brand? And now an unpleasant experience, this is very interesting. We do a lot of work in measuring customer effort. And at the brain level, effort is perceived as pain. So whenever we go through some effort that we have to put into, for example, finding out about our telecom bill, why was there any mismatch between what we thought we had to pay and the bill, or we need to call the bank to fix our credit card or anything. Anytime we go through this effort, our brain perceives it as pain. So it's like if someone was hitting us. We're not aware of that pain, of course, but our brains go like, why? So there is like a red flag, you know, like an alarm. This experience is not okay. Why do you keep doing that? So go away, move to another company, just leave all the premises. You know? So this is very, we as customers and companies are not really aware of that, of the huge impact that effort has on our decision-making and on our relationships with brands. And that translates to emotions, actually. The emotions and the pain that we feel.
I find that very interesting. And there are a couple of things I would like to unpack here. So first, this perception of our brain's perception of effort and treating it as pain, is this one of the factors why people tend to avoid difficult decisions or postpone them? Simply because they're triggered that way, right? So what brings, let's say, a difficult decision, something that we may have not faced in our lives yet? What brings it to the surface? What makes it surface from the, let's say, subconscious level, where it's basically habitual, to bringing it to our awareness in a way that makes us stop and reflect about it? What would be the factors that cause it to surface like this?
So I'm not so sure I understood your question. So you're saying if we are faced with a difficult decision, how do we process it consciously?
Yes, yes.
Okay, okay. So mainly our brains, whenever we have to take a decision, our brains look back into memory, searching for a similar situation and searching for the actions that we took and the results. So the brain is a comparison machine. And it goes very, very fast, sifting through all the information that we have, trying to see which situation matches the one that we are in currently. If it finds a favorable outcome, then pretty much the behavior is going to be similar to what we did in the past. Because our brain knows, well, if you did that and it was safe, do it again, you might be safe. And of course, it takes into account context and some other elements that we have around us. So this is how the processing happens. This is not conscious. We are not. We might remember consciously something that happened in the past, but most of the processing is subconscious, and our brain just feeds the conscious level a short list saying, "Hey, you can do this or that or that, and this is what might happen." So just, you know, kind of decide what is the course and what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
This is pretty much how it works.
That's very helpful because the context that we live in now, where everyone perceives that change has accelerated a lot, that there's more uncertainty than humans have ever dealt with, and complexity, and everything is happening at the same time. How do our past experiences, let's say, how much can they indicate what future success looks like? So I to sum this up, I found a phrase that stuck with me, and it's actually a book that's called What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And I found that very interesting because it paused me to stop and challenge myself and figure out if these past experiences can actually be as helpful as I think they would be to indicate, you know, a potential solution to a problem or a specific choice. So how do you think that's maybe changing right now?
So if we refer to the current situation with the pandemic and everything that we are going through, it is very interesting that our brains, especially the younger people, we don't have any similar situation to compare. We've never been through such a ubiquitous threat, let's say. We've never been through a critical situation like that. So our brain is really, I should say, lost into, you know, telling us which is the best path. So this was very interesting for me since I started working in consumer behavior. I developed this eye to observe things and to analyze them consciously, you know. So I started, when the whole thing happened also in Romania, I started looking around to see how do people react, how do customers react, and what's going on. So almost everybody froze, including me. So we're all in this, you know, frozen state where we're trying to figure out what to do. And it's normal to a certain level, because we're absorbing information, trying to, you know, figure out the best path for each of us. And then, of course, you have people's risk averseness coming into play. You have people's mindset also influencing that. So in order to be able to survive through uncertainty, let's say, if we want to call it like that, first of all, you need to be able to put in a lot of effort, cognitive effort. Uncertainty drives cognitive effort, and people are very unhappy with that. So this is what we also found from our work in doing consumer behavior assessments. Whenever people don't understand information, they don't understand the context or the setting, they're very unhappy. So that's the first step. You need to accept that there's going to be a lot of effort that you need to put into finding the way to go. Then you have to be willing to adapt very fast. Meaning what was right in the morning might not be right in the afternoon, where you have new information showing you that it's safe or not safe to go outside or whatever. Then you have to be to have a flexible mindset. So you might change your behavior, you might change your habits, and you have to accept that and be willing to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're rigid, you might be in trouble. And this, of course, comes to how we're wired. Some of us are more flexible. Some of us are more rigid. Some of us are okay to navigate through uncertainty. Some of us are not. So, for example, being an entrepreneur, navigating through uncertainty every day, that helps you with this current situation. That's like a side joke, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I guess these are the, this is how we learn how to get through a uncertain context or environment.
These are very helpful. And I've seen kind of, and I've also seen it on myself, the toll that this cognitive effort takes at some point, if you don't give yourself enough breathing room. And again, I've been reading about all these things and I've been working with a coach for a long time, but I still found it difficult. So I constantly put in this effort, but it was kind of, let's say, didn't realize the toll that it took on me until like a few weeks ago, when I started really feeling depleted and very, very tired and tired. Emotionally and cognitively tired, that I just could not take in anymore. So, and I curbed like the stimuli that I let into my life a long time ago, and I'm trying to keep them under control. So I kind of regulate how much news I take in. I've deleted my Facebook account for almost 3 years now. So I've done a lot of work in this, but it still was very, very difficult, even with, let's say, training, because I feel lucky and privileged to have had access to therapy and coaching and things that help you boost all these abilities and build them gradually. But it still took quite a toll. And what I've seen is that, well, obviously, many people went in survival mode, whether they realized it or not. And decision making is very difficult. So making choices in survival mode is very difficult than when we're, let's say, in a calm state or in your regular kind of average day-to-day context. What have you found that's particularly different about how people make decisions where in their survival mode or extreme situations that activate that instinct that we have to either fight or flight, or, well, for some of us, it may be freeze, because that's a third option as well.
Yeah, so we become very risk averse when we are in survival mode and there is a threat out there and we do not know what the threat is, we don't know how to react. We become very risk averse, and our brains is just, they're trying to keep us, you know, safe, put in a place where at least they can control the environment. So this is one of our brain's most important roles, to keep us safe and to control the environment. So therefore it kind of, so this is very funny. I'll give you an example. My boy is 10, and, before the pandemic, every weekend he wanted us to go somewhere, just to a playground or just to go somewhere. So he gets out of the house, you know? So, when the pandemic started, I explained to him that it is dangerous and they would not go to the supermarket. And he told me, I think last week, he said something, I have two voices in my head. One is telling me that I want to go out and have fun and meet my friends and go play. But the other one is telling me that it is dangerous and the risk outweighs the benefit. So therefore, I listen to my other voice that tells me to stay inside, it is safe. And I'm not, I don't remember his wording, but he said, I'm not bothering you with all my requests to go out. And, you know, I'm being a quiet kid, something like that. And I looked at him and I was like, yeah, this is exactly what happens in our brains. I mean, he verbalized it so well. And because of that, we refrained all our desires to do anything that was dangerous. Or most of us refrained it, because of course there are people that are not so risk averse and they just take any risk, they don't care. So, but I'm talking about the majority of the population, let's say.
Mm.
So now, yeah, so we become risk averse, and everything that is not directly related to the threat of our survival or the survival, our brain just ignores it. You know, it just says, this is noise. I'm not going to pay attention to that. I'm just going to process the information that is related to how to wash your hands, get sanitizer, don't go out, how to order groceries and stuff like that. Another important thing is that the relationships that were important or strong, they become more important. And I'm talking here about personal relationships and also a relationship without a brand. So if you're engaged with a brand, you're going to get more engaged because that is a safe spot for you. The brain tells you this brand is safe. You can interact with it. So you'll continue to do more business with that company, brand, whatever. Whereas the connection, the weak connections are just going to vanish. They're not important. Your brain tells you, well, you should not spend energy and time in that direction because there's nothing there. So it just, you disengage with anything that's not important. And this is a very important lesson for brands, because if we look around what happened in communication, a lot of brands decided not to say anything. They just, you know, hid themselves. I understand that they didn't know what to do. There was a lot of risk involved. So on one hand, I understand. But on the other hand, if you look at the consumer, he needs that assurance from a brand.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't provide that, the consumer is going to brain. It's going to say, well, this is not important for my survival. It doesn't help me in this situation. So I'm going to ignore it. And then when I go back to my habits, I'm not going to include you in my habit because you're not there anymore.
That is very interesting. I really particularly like this point, and I think it has a lot of weight into how we behave these days and how we kind of how we take in information, because I think that that's one of the biggest things that's exploded in consumption. Information consumption has skyrocketed, and we can see it in the fact that, internet traffic has increased a lot, and it has increased a lot for social media, news apps, and so on and so forth. So there are all these elements when we're in survival mode, just to sum up, especially our brains kind of function to filter out irrelevant information and weak ties, which I think is very important. And we've seen this. I've seen many people, kind of triggered to reflect, intentionally or not, but a lot of people kind of went into reflection mode and realized, kind of got clarity around what important aspects or elements of their lives were and what matters and what doesn't. There was this general, let's say, filtration of everything that's going on in our lives, plus this this tendency to seek out familiarity. But doesn't that also trigger our confirmation bias, which I find is one of the most, let's say, dangerous biases that we have, especially when we consume information? And for those who don't know, I just wanted to mention that confirmation bias is the human tendency to seek out information and facts that corroborate and support the arguments and the story we already have built in our heads that we're already telling ourselves. How have you seen that maybe influence consumers' behavior or behavior in general?
This is related to the echo chamber, you know, where we live in our own
bubble.
Bubble, yeah, exactly. I just saw the title of an article saying that, you know, the first link you get when you Google something on Google, the first link is like the strongest, the first news would be one that supports your belief. Mm. And then the next link would be one that is like a weaker, but still supports your belief and so on, you know? So, this is very dangerous because this is how we become radical, and this is how we are not open to analyzing new information and new data that comes in. But this is, there are around 175 biases that are at play when we look at people behavior. So we are not aware of them, and even if we are aware of them, we might not change, and if we were not able to change it, this is how our brain works, you know?
Yeah. So what can we do about it? It takes a lot of effort. I've seen it in myself and in others who read about, you know, who've been reading about, let's say, psychology and sociology and every other branch that ties into our behavior. And we all know, I mean, if you work with a coach, you learn to spot these things and you learn to see how your cognitive distortions modify your behavior and your decisions so you can, you know, course correct and figure out a more rational way to behave and to proceed. But how can we live with them in a way that doesn't affect our lives too much? Because it certainly, we can't erase them, and we definitely can't learn to have like a perfect critical thinking machine. We're not able to do that. We're only human at the end of the day. But how can we live with them?
So biases are not really, they're not bad. They're not inherently bad, you know. I mean, okay, some of them are good, some of them are bad. they are shortcuts. They are a way that our brain manages to go through life and still get a good outcome of the decisions that we take. So if we're in settings where we don't understand the information, we don't really know how to navigate, then relying on biases, it's going to help us, because at least we have a path, you know. On the other hand, biases are bad because we do not put in the effort to analyze the information. So and we jump to conclusions, and then depending on the bias, so if we talk about, let's say, women in science bias, yeah, and we look at someone and we say, well, how can she be a scientist? Look at her. That's bad, because that blocks our willingness to analyze the information and to take a decision based on what we see. So I remember once I was flying with KLM, and you know, when the plane takes off, it's like the captain talking, and there was this woman voice saying, "I am your captain," and my first reaction was like, "Oh my God, she's a woman! Why?" You know, so I got a bit anxious. then I analyzed it immediately. So I was like, "But why am I thinking that? I mean, she's for sure, she knows how to fly a plane, so that's not an issue. And why?" I mean, I was like, I got upset with myself. Why did I become anxious? There's no reason for me to become anxious, you know? But the first reaction was that, like, oh, she's not a guy. Okay.
These are very deeply ingrained, aren't they? Even if we don't want them, even if we're like educated people who have read a lot, but we can still see these knee-jerk reactions that we have. And it's just, I think what helps is to have that afterthought, that kind of process that kicks in and says, hey, this is something you should challenge. This is something you should look beyond. Don't stick with this path.
Exactly. So it's very important for us to analyze that. We might not be able to change it. So the next time I might react the same, but at least I'm aware, so my brain is going to recall the memory, say, hey, relax, it's okay, you've been through that, so don't worry, I mean, or accept it, because it's okay, you know. And I think that's the second action that we need to take, and that's very important, is to educate our kids and to educate the people around us to see those biases and to be aware of them as much as we can. And here I also have another personal story where I have a boy and a girl. So when my boy is 10, and when he was young, I would buy all kind of tools and toys for him to where he would have to build and use his imagination. And then when my girl, she was growing, I was trying to buy the same toys for her. But what do you find when you go in the store? You find kitchens, you find dolls, makeup. And I was very, very upset. I was like enraged at some point. I was like, why? Of course there is this bias where women grow and they cook and guys fix things around, because this is how they play. And it was, I remember another interesting study where they had these toddlers, you know, were actually almost babies, I think 6 months, 7 months old, and they dressed them as boys and girls, and they got volunteers to play with them. If the baby was dressed as a girl, the volunteer would play with girl toys. If the baby was dressed as a boy, would play with boy toys. Actually, they dressed them, they mixed them, you know, and people were, so that's a bias, and the volunteers, they did not do it on purpose. They just thought that would be the most appropriate toy to play with.
Exactly. There's a lot that we still need to change. I sometimes feel, and I know how this may sound, let's say, slightly as a critique to the human to human evolution, but I don't think so. We live in such a complex world, but I feel that sometimes our brains or our patterns, our behavior has not evolved enough compared to where we want it to be or where we expect it to be or what we expect of ourselves. And I've seen, I mean, this is something that's very visible in, let's say, throughout all areas of society, but especially how children behave today and how their brain absorbs and processes information versus what people are used to in terms of kind of nurturing them and helping them grow up. And there's such a big difference. They're so incredibly smart. They don't see gender gaps because these are all learned behaviors. And it takes, I know it takes a long time for mentalities to change. When I was studying PR and communication, we did a lot of kind of, we studied anthropology and everything else. And it stuck with me that mentalities change once every 50 years, if so. And I feel that it kind of has remained the same in spite of this advance and general acceleration of everything. What other things are not changing about human behavior and how we make decisions? Because I feel like there's a lot of talk about change, but at the same time, the decisions that people make for us, let's say on a bigger level, are still driven by the same things. And that's why we see patterns, let's say, in past events that are similar to what we're going through now. And obviously this cycle of history repeating itself endlessly. So what are those things that don't change about human behavior that are big influences on our choices?
I think the way our brains work does not change. And that's a good thing, because if it changed, then you might have mutations and then you don't know what would come out of those mutations. So it's pretty much the role of habits that they play in our decision-making, the role of emotions or the impact of emotions that plays in our decision making. I think those are two aspects that do not change. Of course, what changes is how we interpret reactions, and our decisions are pretty much context and culture driven. And how we explain those and how we motivate them changes from culture to culture, you know. But if we look at the primary reactions or the brain processes, they're the same. If you go through, I don't know, if you think of a mother's reaction to protect her kids, they're the same across cultures. Yeah. But the way she does this and she, her actions and her behavior might be different from culture to culture. So this also translates probably at a higher level, but now if we talk about, you know, if we go into politics or like administration, there are different, I think the decision is different because there are other elements that come into play that are just distorting the way people decide. So it might not be in the best interest, let's say, of some groups, it might be in the best interest of other groups. So I don't think that's a different
scenario.
Yeah,
that is true. That is true. And I feel maybe that's why we feel so strongly, let's say, challenged by some of these things that don't align with our reality. Around what you said, that our brain hasn't changed, I remembered an example, and I haven't thought about this in over 10 years. When we were at the university, we had this fantastic teacher that taught us communication, and we studied all sorts of things. And one of the things I remember, one of the studies that he quoted, is that they found a tribe in the Amazon a bunch of years ago, and they showed different emotions, but just the people's eye, just people's eyes, and they could recognize each of those emotions and name them just as everyone else on the globe would. And that's very, that's a very universal pattern. And I find that very endearing, I guess, because we're all able to recognize emotion in each other, and we all have these shared patterns, but sometimes the way we interpret things culturally makes us drift apart. And we see that a lot in social media. We see that a lot in the comment section of insert any website here.
That's a very interesting point you brought up. And probably it was Ekman, your professor was referring to Paul Ekman, where he's the father of facial recognition, facial coding, let's say, with the seven emotions. But recently I read another book that's called How Are Emotions Formed in the Brain or something like that, that challenged everything that I thought and I knew about emotions. Very interesting book, very technical. So it's not for, let's say, at a layman level. So it goes very deep into brain processes. But the argumentation is the following. It's not mainly the emotions that are global and easily recognizable. It's the expression that people have, and based on their faces, and based on the concepts that those tribe or the cultures have, based on the concepts, people are able to recognize the emotion. And the example that she gives, they also went to tribes. So the book is written by a professor. I forgot her name, but I can put it in the, I can send you the link. And she has PhD students, and they also went to some tribes and did research. And what they showed people, the faces, they didn't tell them any concept. They didn't tell them this is happiness, this is sadness, this is fear. And the reaction would be people are laughing. They look at someone laughing and say, people are laughing. They didn't say happiness. They said laugh. Because they didn't know the concept of happiness. They didn't have it in their vocabulary, and they didn't know how to verbalize it, you know? And the point that she's making is that we are teaching our kids concepts since they are young, since they're babies. So when a mother talks to the child and she tells the baby, I am upset because you did that, or why are you crying? Are you upset? The kid hears upset, you know, being upset, and correlates it with crying, or are you angry? Don't throw the toy on the floor. I'm getting angry. So we are, because we are able to talk and to use a common language that the other person understands, we transfer the concepts, and then they know to recognize the emotion based on the concept that they learned. So she's saying that it's not that emotions are global, and we are able to recognize the emotion, or able to recognize the concept that we learned. And if we don't have the concept, our brain doesn't know what to do with that.
I find that super interesting, especially because one thing that I've found since doing this podcast, and since kind of devoting a lot more attention to decision making, both in my personal life and noticing what goes on around me, is that sometimes one of the reasons we have, so let's say we have to put in a lot more effort to figure out these complex things in our lives, is that we lack the vocabulary to do so. We don't know how to name these things. And when our brain can't identify it, when it doesn't have that concept to rely on, it's very difficult for us to actually figure out what that looks like. I'm absolutely thrilled that behavioral psychology and every other branch that touches on human behavior have kind of surfaced a bit into mainstream media, because we're finally learning how to talk about what we feel and what we think, and we're finally giving ourselves this opportunity. But at the same time, I know you did a lot of research into how people act when they're particularly on consumer behavior and how people act when they're shopping and when they choose what to consume and what to buy. But I wanted to ask you what the difference is, speaking of vocabulary, what the difference is between what they do and what they say, because that's that distance usually reveals kind of all our biases and things that are going on without us, well, subconscious, let's say, actions or reactions that we have. Could you share a few examples on that?
Mm-hmm. So since we started doing consumer neuroscience, we saw that there is a gap between what people say and what they think. And that gap comes from either people are not aware, either they don't want to say. If you're researching a topic that's sensitive, people might not want to tell you. Or people just oftentimes they resort to the first answer that comes to their minds just to move on. So if we have a focus group or you ask people, why would you buy this product? Why do you like it? And stuff like that. They just give you the first answer that comes to their mind, because why would they put in more effort to do to introspect themselves and to see why do they really like the product? Or so I remember a project that we did where we looked at employee engagement, and we measured engagement on focus and energy, so two dimensions of people's involvement. And we did we had the declarative survey. So we asked people some questions to see how focused they were and how engaged they were with their work. And then we also did an implicit association test where we measured people's subconscious reactions to those dimensions, so focus and energy. What we found out, the declarative survey showed us that around 80% of the employees were very focused and very energetic. So they were very engaged. And this was consistent to the other studies that the company had. So they had a stellar performance team. When we looked at the implicit association results, around only 20% were in that quadrant of being highly focused and energetic, and they knew exactly what they had to do. And the others were scattered around. They were either less focused and they had a lot of energy, but they were all over the place, or they were focused, but they didn't have the energy to complete their tasks, maybe because they were burnout, or maybe because they were, I don't know, disengaged with their team or whatever. And then there, of course, there were a lot of people that were lacking both focus and energy because they were not in the right place, they were not happy with their work and stuff like that. So when we showed the management team the results, that was eye-opening for them, because they told us, we already knew that there were issues that we needed to fix. We knew that the team was not performing as they should, but all the studies that we had showed us that 80% were, you know, good. So we couldn't go in and change anything, because the team leader would say, well, but my team, look at that. I have great people. Why would I want to change anything? So yeah, there is a gap between what people say and what they do. And it's not that people are misleading you. They might not know. So we all consider ourselves to be, you know, very good people, to be responsible, to be unbiased. Of course, we are rational and we analyze everything, and biases don't work for us. But it's not like that. It's when I started reading about neuromarketing, and I read about the decisions that they are not rational and conscious, I didn't agree with that. I said, no, that's not possible. I'm a very rational person. I analyze everything. I don't let emotions get me, you know. And then I started reading more, and I went like, okay, so maybe I was not right and my perception was wrong. And yeah, I completely changed my view on how people decide and how they react.
Oh, that's super interesting. And that was actually one of the things that I wanted to explore, simply because I'm sure that working with all these concepts and constantly adding new layers of, let's say, complexity and understanding to all these issues change the way you behave in your personal life, not just in your professional life. What have been some of these changes that you saw in your own behavior over time?
So I'm trying to minimize the impact of biases.
Aren't we all?
Yeah. I'm having fun observing myself.
Oh, I love that. I've never heard that. I tend to take myself very seriously, which is something I'm trying to work on. But I've never heard someone say they have fun with this. And I guess it should be fun, right? To give ourselves... To make it a source of pleasure for our brain and not constantly a source of effort.
Yeah.
So how are you having fun with it?
So I remember once I wanted to buy a new car. So that was maybe, 7, 8 years ago. And I knew exactly what kind of car I wanted. I wanted to be large enough to take half of the house with me when we go on vacations with the kids. I wanted it to be higher. So I could, like an SUV, because I wanted to, in my mind, that was related to safety and me being, I'm aware of the biases about, women driving. So I just want to have a big car just like that, because if I have a big car in the intersection, no one is going to mess with me. So these are my perceptions. Yeah. So we went to different brands. Different automakers, and I had a budget in mind, but I didn't really like what I saw. So my husband told me, let's go to another brand. Let's go to this brand. And I said, yeah, but it's out of our budget. So I don't want to spend more than what we decided, because it's just a car. I mean, I don't want to spend more than that. And he said, well, I scheduled you for a test drive, so now we have to go. So I said, yeah, okay, I'm going to go, but I'm not going to buy that car. I'll assure you, I'm not going to spend that money. So then I got into the car and I kind of liked it. I liked the experience. I liked the way it was built. I liked the quality and everything. So while I was driving, when I entered, I said, no way, I'm not going to buy. Just make sure, I was talking to myself, just make sure you're not going to get this car, just to know. And then I started loving it. And I was like, but I really like it. I mean, it's different than the other ones. So then I was aware that I was like, my brain was like, okay, so let's find now, let's just to appease your rational brand, let's find some benefits so that you can buy the car. So then probably the sales guy saw me that I like the car. So he told me, well, this is the, we are having a new model coming in. So if you buy this car, that's the old model, I can give you this discount. I can give you the highest, all the, how do you call it, the perks and the highest motorization.
No, all the equipment,
Yeah. So, and you also get a discount, and you also get tires, and you also get that and that. So then when I started writing everything, putting it on paper in an Excel file to see what is, it was kind of, it looked like a pretty good deal, And I convinced my rational brain that it is actually a pretty good deal if you look at all the other perks that you get on top of that. So I ended up buying that car.
I think that one of the things that you've mentioned previously as well is that we should give ourselves kind of this a bit of freedom to change our minds and to make that okay. Because for a long time, and what we saw in society as well, was this idea of obviously staying true to yourself, to your principles, and every other decision and choice should be aligned with that particular story and structure that we have instilled in ourselves. It's just that so many things around us that are changing. And what I find particularly interesting about neuroscience and neuropsychology is that we have all these studies coming up, and there's been obviously a lot more budget and funding available to uncover these things than ever before, that we have all these things coming up that challenge what we thought we knew about how the brain works, how the human mind works, how our behavior, why our behavior is the way it is. And it happens in, nutrition as well, things that we thought were good, turn out to be bad. And some of the things that were touted as really, really bad turn out to be not that bad. And it's difficult for us to absorb all these shifts, all these changes and things that we thought were fundamental. How do you particularly deal with these kind of changes or these new discoveries that really shake up some of the structural elements of our lives?
Mm-hmm. So as a scientist, I know that it's very important to have an open mind and to be willing to accept that you were wrong. I think this is one of the most important factors that help you grow as a person, as a scientist also. Because, as you said, the research challenged a lot of our assumptions. And if you have a fixed mindset, fixed meaning that you don't want to change your beliefs, then you cannot grow, because it is okay to accept that based on our current understanding, this is how we think the brain works, this is what we think it's good for us. But in 20 years, we might find out that we're completely wrong, because it's like it's you at this moment, you just see a bit of a picture. Then if, as science progresses and you learn more and you have a deeper understanding, the picture broadens or it gets deeper depending on how you look at it.
Mm.
So it is normal that you might see things differently. It's just okay. You have to accept that. You don't beat yourself up because you believed something in good faith. And I also tend to take everything with a grain of salt now. So I'm not really, I don't believe 100% everything I hear, especially if it's new. If there are new discoveries, I'm a bit like, how should I say, skeptical, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And just wait to see. Okay, let's wait for another 2-3 years and see if this discovery just proves to be right or wrong. So yeah, this is how I approach it.
That is very helpful and kind of relying on time-tested principles. I mean, I guess that's why Stoicism is making a comeback and other things that have been around for thousands of years, simply because they haven't changed. So that's why I find it fascinating that human nature, well, let's say the core components are kind of still the same, are initial brain, the one that formed around our sense of smell and that directs all these subconscious reactions, is still the one that also that always triggers before our rational brain. And we tend to forget that simply because there's this distance in time between that point and this point where we are now. I wanted to ask one of my last question is around, you mentioned that you take everything with a grain of salt, and there's definitely, I mean, we need to cultivate, it's important for us to cultivate our ability to see nuance and to understand that most things are not black and white. They're usually on a spectrum, and that dealing with the spectrum takes a lot of effort. But there's also this tendency that I think everyone noticed of challenging things, well, with one agenda or another, based on one agenda or another, challenging things and trying to bring them down. Like, we see a lot of conspiracy theories, and they're widely circulated. And we've seen many, many things. I mean, there are tons of examples out there. Depending on when you listen to this, pick your example. How do we make sure that we stay in this letting in and accepting that there are multiple possibilities and multiple interpretations? How do we make sure that we keep this on a constructive and positive note and not let it slip into conspiracy theories and kind of behaviors that tend to lead to radical opinions that hurt the people or groups or societies at large?
Yeah, so this is very interesting and a very good question. I developed for myself a sense of, whenever I see a new movement, call it whatever you want to call it, all the hashtags, whenever I see it evolving, I become very critical of it. Either if it doesn't matter whether it's aligned with my principles or and values, or it is not aligned, I start to dissect it and to see who benefits from that, what are the forces at play, how is manipulation working with people, you know, and how is it influencing? Because what I've seen in the last years with, as I said, society, political, different kind of movements, most of them had an agenda. Most of them had some, they might have been good movements in the beginning. So they're like, you know, they were fueled by good intentions, but then they got derailed by some agenda or the other. So I think the key word here is balance. Of course, you have your own values and principles and beliefs, and you need to stick to them because they represent you and they are a choice. You choose to believe in something and to act in a certain way. But you have to be skeptical and to just keep a distance and analyze who's benefiting from that, who's driving the agenda, who's behind. Do a bit of research and see who's paying for that, promoting the post, if we talk about social media, you know, if you have time and you have the interest to do research. Otherwise, which I don't really have time for that, I'm just keeping a bit of a distance and see how does this unravel. And then I decide whether I want to take a part in it or not.
That is very helpful. And I think those questions, and I'll make sure to write them in the show notes. I think these questions are very, very helpful. And I believe in the power of questions to helping us kind of extract things from reality that we wouldn't normally, because we don't have these questions at the top of our mind. They're not a reflex. They're not a habit. And just having them and just sometimes seeing them, but working with them in writing would be the best way to help our brain assimilate.
And all those movements, they play on our biases. You know, we might be more, we might favor one action or the other, or one stance or the other. And if we look at them, they play on a lot of biases in society, which is, again, is tricky because whoever is driving the agenda knows that people as a mass are going to react in different ways, and they're just playing on those reactions and feeling. So I think it's a lot of manipulation.
There is. And speaking of things that strengthen our critical thinking and our ability to see, recognize, and work with these things and kind of manage them and manage our own lives, what are some key resources that you'd recommend listeners just to start maybe building or expanding their vocabulary and adding new concepts to their toolbox so they can make it easier for themselves to make sound decisions and have like a sound rationale?
So some of the authors that shaped me as I grew professionally are Ariely, Dan Ariely. He is my favorite behavioral economist, and he opened my eyes to how irrational we can be. So I recommend all of his books. I started with Predictably Irrational, as probably everybody
same.
Most people have heard of it. I moved into reading all his books. So I think his understanding his approach to, you know, testing different settings and different and people's reactions, understanding and internalizing that approach, it is very helpful for us as professionals and also as human beings, you know. Then I would recommend the work of Thaler and Sunstein on nudges and behaviors and how to influence, how to help people build a better life, if you want. Of course, we have to be careful that these nudges can be used in a negative way or in a wrong direction, but that is, you know, the regulator's responsibility to make sure that nudges and all these processes are benefiting, to make sure that all these nudges and processes are benefiting people, the population.
I do have, sorry to interrupt, but I do have a quick example here. I remember a couple of months ago, a friend of mine showed me a website where you could actually, let's say, commission, well, start a campaign to specifically target a person with a particular kind of messaging. So, for example, if you'd want your spouse to stop smoking, you could pay for a custom campaign that would bombard them with ads wherever they go with that particular message. And of course, it can be used in a negative way as well. And that felt so weird, unethical, very, very intrusive, and just so wrong. And we were both talking about it. I mean, we both work in marketing, and you have all this experience. And it triggered me to like, what I know that behavior can be manipulated in many ways, and we all kind of influenced by many, many things. But this is so, so wrong. And just examples like these just are just the tip of the iceberg. It's just a tiny, tiny bit of everything that's going on in our lives. So understanding these nudges might help us recognize them, see them in reality, and just keep them from overwhelming us and take away our power to decide what is right for us.
Exactly. Once we become aware and we are informed as consumers, as citizens, then it is a bit more difficult to manipulate us and to sway our decisions based on different agenda. Of course, it is still possible because we are humans, and there is this familiarity effect. If you hear something over and over and over, you start to believe it, kind of start to think, well, there might be some truth in it, and it affects your decisions. It affects the way you look at an issue.
That is very helpful. And thank you for sharing all these resources and stories and examples. It's been such an insightful conversation. And I think that whoever wants to kind of pursue particular topics, they can have their pick at all of these rosters of examples and resources and start digging a lot deeper. If anyone wants to follow your work, what would be the best place to do that?
They can connect with me on LinkedIn or go on buyerbrain.com and see what we do. And if they can write to me also, there is my email address on the website. So yeah.
Perfect. Thank you so, so much. I'll put everything that we mentioned and talked about in the show notes. And maybe at some point I would love to kind of build on this conversation and take it further. You've been extremely generous. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your invitation, Andra, and thank you for the pleasant conversation, and have a lovely weekend.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the episode. You can find links to all the resources we mentioned in the show notes. If you have feedback, please share it in a review on iTunes or any other podcast app you're using. I want to understand how to make the show better and more useful for everyone involved. You can always reach me on my blog or on Twitter. You can also subscribe to the weekly email I send. It comes packed with great resources focused on, what else? Decision making. Don't be a stranger, and thanks again for listening.